Hi, everybody, and welcome to the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballengee. It's good to have you here with us. I've been on vacation last week. So I was down in Orlando. I was at the tournament that I have with my in-laws every year. This is the 14th year, I think, that I've been on the trip, called the Greensburg Cup, or the old Greensburg Cup, depending on who you ask. And they've been doing this trip for a little over 30 years now, which is pretty incredible. And so now into its third generation of players. So I've kind of been in the second generation of the players who have been involved with it. And we have 13 guys this year. We had a new guy this year. And we all get together. And for all the years that I've been on this trip, although it hasn't always been here, it's been in Orlando. So we rent a house, huge house, you know, with enough beds for everybody and enough bedrooms and nice pool, a little hot tub. We all get together and play five rounds of golf and have a couple of different competitions, a match play competition and a modified Stableford scoring system competition. And it's just such a great time. It's really a lot of fun to be able to spend those days just enjoying the weather that we are not used to having this time of year up in this part of the country, in the Mid-Atlantic region, for some people in the Northeast, but some people come from Tennessee and Illinois, which is definitely not as nice, Pennsylvania, all over. And it was a special week, as it always is, but we have a special week this week. We have the Players' Championship at TPC Sawgrass in Pontevedra Beach, Florida. Biggest tournament of the year on the PGA Tour, I would argue. I know the Tour Championship is a bigger purse, and the FedEx Cup is the quote-unquote ultimate prize, but I think in the history of the sport, the Players' Championship is a bigger deal. It's been around for, what, almost 50 years? It's been over 50 years at this point, right? I mean, 1973. So we're getting close to the 50-year anniversary of the Players' Championship. And it has taken on a life that isn't quite a major, but is definitely bigger than a regular event. And it's definitely bigger than really any other invitational event. So it's solidly probably the fifth most important tournament in the world. I would tell you in terms of field quality, field strength, it's probably the second best. The PGA Championship has historically, really in recent memory, not forever, but in recent memory, been the deepest, the best tournament because they've gone out of their way to invite the top 100 in the world in the official World Golf Ranking to compete. We'll see if that changes with LIV this year, whether they will still kind of take the same steps or they'll have LIV players not invited or they'll work around that. I don't know what that's going to look like. But if it does, then that means the Players' Championship will probably be the deepest field in golf because they have 43, 44, the world top 50. They have 144 players in the field. Everybody that got through the top 125 last year will qualify. You've got players who are playing well this year that are a part of the field. And you've got some top 50 players who are invited that are not PGA Tour members. So like Minwoo Lee, for example, is not a PGA Tour member, but because he's top 50, he's able to compete in this tournament, which has kind of taken a major-like criteria in some ways. I love this tournament. It's one of the first tournaments I've ever covered. Back in 2003, when I was in college, I covered two tournaments, and this was the first one because it was still in March then. And I don't know how I got a credential, and I will say thank you forever to the folks of the PGA Tour who, for some reason, let me have a credential because I had a quote-unquote radio show, which was really streaming on like Real Player, if you remember that, and to an audience of, I don't know, 1,000 people a week is my guess. I think that was at the point where iPods had come out and more people were listening to the show because of podcasting becoming a thing. But they gave me a press credential and I went down during my spring break when I was in college to go cover the tournament. I had never really traveled by myself before. Figured out how to get there and figured out how to cover a golf tournament as best I could. And I didn't really know anybody. Didn't know anyone in the press center. I mean, I'm not really sure exactly why I did it other than that I could do it. And walked around the golf course. Had a camera confiscated. Didn't know any of the rules about taking pictures or not taking pictures. Probably should have studied that a little bit better. Davis Love III had my picture or my camera taken from me because he won. But he was the guy whose picture I snapped. And then I got it back. It was fine. But it was a tournament that has always had an interesting memory for me because I think I've done it 4 times now. And each time has kind of been an interesting point in my life. I mean, it being the first tournament in 03 And then in 2011, I went when I was part of the NBC sports crew and doing their golf blogging. Obviously, it's a big event for them, so they didn't necessarily want me to be there. They didn't have to have me there, but they were willing to let me go. And I went and got to meet all of the folks who do the television side of things, from Dan Hicks to Roger Maltby to Gary Koch. I mean, you name them, go down the line. And they were really nice to spend time with. And that was at a time when I thought I had it made, that I was going to be NBC's golf guy in perpetuity. And obviously, it didn't work out that way. And then the last time I went was in 2017 with a group of influential golf bloggers at the time before the term influencer existed, and spent the week with Brendan Porath and Kyle Porter and the No Laying Up guys. And we all got together in a house for a week, and it was fantastic. It was so much fun. And then I was still with Yahoo thinking, okay, well, you know, the world's pretty good. I'm running their golf blog, and I was still kind of doing GNN and starting to kind of build it, but wasn't ready to make the switch yet. So maybe I have to go back next year, and maybe life will be in a different place, because it is now, right? I mean, GNN Radio is a thing. Golf News Net has grown tremendously. I've done this on my own for almost 6 years now. It'll be 6 years in June of doing this on my own. It'd be my own business. And so for me, the Players always kind of has an intrigue because of not only it being a great tournament, but my memories of it are really interesting points in my professional life. And so I kind of always kind of have a romanticism about it. But this week should be really good. I mean, it's $25 million for a purse, $4.5 million to the winner, something like that, which is an incredible figure for any kind of tournament, much less a PGA Tour event that was kind of unfathomable, probably even 5 years ago, that there would be a $25 million tournament. And here we are with that. This golf course is very difficult to play. I've never played it, studied it, tons on the ground. But the golf course is really challenging. There are so many shots that are visually intimidating, that are uncomfortable. And then Pete Dye asks you to do two different things on the same hole, and you almost never hit the same shot in a row twice. That's not the ideal shot twice. And it makes it really frustrating for the players. The windows are much tighter, I think, than what you see on TV, because there are these overhanging branches and twists and turns to the dog legs and the way the hole shape and little pot bunkers and all these things that, if you play the golf course enough times, you know are out there. And I think that's why it makes it more difficult to figure it out early. You kind of learn the hard way how to play Sawgrass. And it just is a golf course where you can never feel like you've got it figured out, because anywhere you turn, something horrible could happen to you and it could ruin your tournament. And that's why I think so many players here do not have a great record, and very few have a consistent record, because it is that difficult to figure out from week to week what you're going to do. Trying to figure out on this golf course how to play it, if you've never figured out how to play it, I think it kind of builds up on you. And then eventually you either commit to doing it and you get it right eventually. Tiger Woods got it right twice. Or you just go batty and you just flail about and never figure it out. But this is going to be a great week. That all said, we now have some more direction, I think, about where the PGA Tour is thinking of going with their designated events, what that world is going to look like starting next year. And this year that we have of 2023 of designated events, we all kind of knew, I think, when it was announced that this was something thrown together quickly with the purpose of keeping the best players that they could keep on the PGA Tour while offering them more money to compete for, and sweetening the player impact program so that they would have effectively guaranteed money for being popular and they could earn the money for being a superior golfer. And then none of those guys would leave. And that was effective, right? And the only people who left were Mito Pereira, Sebastian Munoz, Brendan Steele, Danny Lee. I mean, Brendan Steele and Danny Lee never going to sniff the Pip. And Mito Pereira might have if he had played it out and gotten better, but maybe he just kind of decided that he wanted to take the sure thing and get the money that he could get from Liv and hope, you know, at the end of the contract he could come back to the PGA Tour or that Liv would just pay him more money. And then for Munoz, he's an accomplished player, play on the President's Cup team, but I don't think that he views himself as kind of this superstar material, perhaps. So the PGA Tour did what it had to do. But I think everyone was pretty clear from the outset that this wasn't going to be the permanent solution. And I'm not sure they're going to come to a permanent solution in year two either, from the sounds of things. So Eamon Lynch has kind of been on top of this, like so many things related to Liv and the PGA Tour's interaction over the last couple of years. But it sounds like from what he is reporting and the memo that was produced and published by the PGA Tour from Jay Monahan to players, that they're going to go in the direction of more limited field events with no cuts for the designated event docket, and then have the other part of the schedule, the other half of the schedule effectively, be regular events, regular tournaments that they allow for an opportunity to be a way to get into the designated events, their full field. So you're going to have these 13 tournaments. The FedEx Cup playoffs are going to be included in that. And you're going to have the Century Tournament of Champions. And then you're going to have, probably, it sounds like the Invitationals are still going to be a part of it. And the Majors and the Players. And then they'll figure out the other remaining ones. But whatever the designated docket looks like, it sounds like they're moving in the direction of, but not guaranteed to do, fields of 70 to 78 players with no cut and everyone gets paid. And I can understand the backlash reaction to that. And it was pretty intense from what I saw while I was scrolling on the golf course earlier in the week or last week. But I also don't entirely understand that level of reaction, that level of annoyance of what the PGA Tour is potentially putting out there for their product. And I think a lot of people like to get worked up about the PGA Tour. Not thinking about minutia, not in the way that it's helpful, but in the way that it just seems pedantic. And I understand why cuts are important. I understand the cuts are historically important to golf. Tiger Woods has a no-cut streak that will never get caught because he took so much painstaking effort into making sure he didn't miss the cut, that he got to the weekend, that he got paid for his time and effort. And I think that's not really the case with the modern player. We've not only talked about that in this context. We've talked about it in every other context before. When the money was starting to increase on the PGA Tour this last go-round before we got to $15 and $20 million purses, before it was, you know, when it was starting to creep into 10. Oh, well, these young guys, they don't care about making the cut because they just need 2 good weeks and then they've made multi-million dollar sums. Well, yeah, that's true. And with the money out there now, you don't have to grind it out every week. Not that there isn't pride in doing that, but it doesn't mean as much to cash a $30,000 check when you can make $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 for finishing in the top 15 of many tournaments on the PGA Tour. This isn't about grinding it out anymore. There's none of that. I mean, unless you're a player who's playing 28 to 32 times a year to save your card. So the notion of having a cut is kind of some important requisite for every tournament. I just don't espouse that belief. I could greatly appreciate and understand why cuts are meaningful. But in the grand scheme of the product, I don't think it's that important. And you can have 70 to 78 players go out there and go play in threesomes the first 2 days or twosomes or whatever you want to do, depending on how you set it up. But I think that they need to really work hard at having these tournaments filled up by players who are a mixture of the best from last year, which it sounds like it's going to be the top 50 from the FedEx Cup from the prior year. So if you get to the second stage of the new playoffs, 70, 50, 30 now. So if you get to that second stage, you're into every designated tournament, which would mean effectively a free $1 million your way. An extra bonus on top of the FedEx Cup bonus pool. And then they would bring in, like, let's say 10, the highest ranking 10 players in the FedEx Cup leading into that tournament. And then it also sounds like they're going to try to space out the schedule where you'll have a couple of designated tournaments in a row, and then two or three non-designated tournaments, which will feed into the next two designated tournaments, which will feed into it'll keep this on-off cycle going. And I think that's a scheduling thing for the top players to say, look, the way we did it this year was to get everything done that we can to have designated tournaments. So there's a reason why we have so many in February and March, because we could do them. And we're going to have next year a little better spacing out, perhaps. A little bit. But if we want you to come play these tournaments and we're going to make it lucrative for you to do so, we're going to make sure that you make about $80,000 just for coming, $100,000 just for coming. And you're only going to play back-to-back weeks. So if you play, it sounds like all of the movement is toward Pebble becoming a designated event next year. Awesome. All right, we're going to have Pebble, and then they'll play Genesis the next week. So you have Pebble and Riv back-to-back, probably. And then those players can decide if they want to play Phoenix before or after, however they set it up. Some will, some won't, because it's not going to be a designated tournament. Then we'll get to March. We'll do API and players back-to-back. Okay? You do those tournaments, and you can decide if you want to play whatever the Honda's going to become, or the I want to call it the Transitions Championship, but the Valspar at Innisbrook, you can decide if you want to play that. And then in April, obviously, you've got the Masters. Well, they're probably going to try to turn the Heritage into a designated tournament permanently, if that's the guess. Okay, then we'll play those back-to-back. And then in May, okay, well, we've got the PGA Championship. What's the other of the back-to-back? Wells Fargo, probably. Maybe they sign on to be a permanent one. Or maybe they move the Memorial Tournament. And it's not around Memorial Day anymore, but still the Memorial Tournament. And they do that back-to-back. Something like that. Then in June, you have the U.S. Open. And you have another tournament. Maybe that's Travelers. Maybe it's one that moves around. We don't know. Figure that out. July, you've got the Open Championship. What's the other one? Is that going to be the Scottish Open? Which would be wild. Would love that, actually. Or you get, I don't know, Rocket Mortgage in there, and you make it, or 3M, and they kind of rotate in of tournaments that otherwise get not very good fields. They get to switch in and out of that July slot. And then obviously August is consumed with the FedEx Cup playoffs. But it also sounds like we don't have a plan from the PGA Tour for the fall. I don't think anyone really knows what's happening in the fall. But the idea that was kind of bandied about, although not officially ever, by the PGA Tour was, hey, we could have a more truncated fall schedule, and you could have all the players who don't qualify for the FedEx Cup playoffs forced into those tournaments at varying levels of prepackaged points so that they have to maintain their tour status, whether that's the top 75 that didn't make it out of the 125, or top, I should say, 55, and then the 75 that got in from the Corn Ferry Tour finals that no longer exist, and that's it? I don't know. I really don't. And it doesn't seem like a lot's been done there. Because at one time, you're also saying, the PGA Tour is kind of saying, okay, well, we want to do two a month, but we also may take away the requirement that every player compete in every designated tournament to qualify for the PIP. Which maybe they've just figured, look, if you're in a $20 million tournament, you're going to play it regardless. You might skip one, but you're probably going to play it. Maybe that's the calculation. Or maybe they're trying to say, we don't know how to figure out the fall. And so we're not going to kill the fall as we understand it, because that would create more problems than it's worth. And I think your most obvious problems would be the Houston Open, CJ Cup, and the Zozo, particularly the Zozo and CJ. I mean, they're eight-figure purse events, and they're limited field tournaments. So is there a way that you can have those be the two tournaments back-to-back in the fall that the the top players play. You make them $20 million tournaments, back-to-back weeks in Asia, and you're done with it. Maybe that's what they do. And then they build the rest of the fall around that. That has nothing to do with being an elevated event. They're just the whatever they come up with, concoct for the fall. Point system, no point system, whatever. That's what they come up with. But if you are not a top 50 player in the world, you've got to be concerned about that. You've got to wonder what is in store, because there's no public information that I've seen that suggests they've got a really good handle on what the fall is going to look like. If you don't have a handle on what the fall is going to look like, that affects way more players, frankly, than the ones that would get into and reliably stay in the designated series. Because you're going to have at least 150 of them. You just are. And like it or not, and this is changing, but this is a tour that has to represent its entire membership, or at least should seek to, based on its status as a membership group. So you've got to be able to go to players and give them a clear idea of, here's what your schedule is going to look like, here's the money that you're playing for, here's how you get into the designated tournaments if you can, here's what you get FedEx Cup points-wise for the non-designated tournaments, and here's how you save your card if you don't get into the playoffs, and therefore don't get into, potentially, if you get the second round of the playoffs, get in all the designated tournaments. That's got to be figured out. And I think there's competing interests there, right? Because if you have a designated series like this, where you have 13 tournaments, put the majors aside, they're their own thing, they're full field affairs with cuts. But if you have 13 tournaments, and all of them have no cut and guaranteed money, they have to come up with a way to deny FedEx Cup points to the lagging performers of that week. I think that's reasonable. And maybe you say the top 50, I don't know, top 3/4 of the field, top 2/3 of the field, whatever that is, gets FedEx Cup points. Everybody gets money, but if you finish beyond 50th or so, you're not going to get any kind of points. And then you go to the full field events and you say, okay, because of the added number of players, everybody who makes the cut is going to get points. So there's a little bit of incentive to play a little bit better in the designated tournaments. There's still a reward for making a cut in a full field event versus a smaller field in a designated event compared to a regular event. But I do think that they have to come up with a system where they can value tournaments differently for FedEx Cup points. But right now you have effectively four types of tournaments. You've got the opposite field events. They have 300 points to the winner. All of the regular events that aren't the playoffs, 500 points to the winner. The three invitationals, 550 to the winner. The four majors and the players, 600 points. And then you've got the two FedEx Cup playoff events that are 2,000 to the winner, right? I think you need to kind of scale that out a little differently. You've got to create two separate categories of points for standard events, and you probably either dock those or you increase the points available for the designated tournaments. And yes, you may not get points if you finish worse than 50th, but you can get more points for winning, you get more points for finishing well because of their deeper fields. So maybe you say, if we still have opposite field events, you can still have those at the 300-point level, or maybe you have them at the 200-point level, I don't know. Then you come in with your standard events, and you have, we'll keep it at 500. But then you have your designated series, and maybe you make that 750 or 1,000 points to the winner. I don't think you can make it so vastly different between the two styles of event, because after all, this is a tour that has to represent a lot of players. And I don't think from the marketing slogan standpoint, you want to say, well, everybody gets in the designated event is worth twice as much as everyone who plays only in the regular events. So maybe you do a 1.5, maybe it's 750 to the winner of a designated tournament. But you need to give a clear pathway to every player as to how they earn points, get in the playoffs, keep a card, getting designated tournaments. And you need to be able to create a fair amount of turnover, I think, from year to year, to be in the designated series or not. And that means you need to have an opportunity to earn a lot of points from the regular series, the regular events, if you break up the schedule. And that may just mean, okay, then we've got to have a lower multiple difference between the designated ones and the regular ones. And that way, if you play a whole ton of regular events and you manage to do well, not only are you going to get in the playoffs, you're going to give yourself an opportunity then to get into the designated series. Now, what I would say is then this is an opportunity to change the FedEx Cup playoffs. Make them true playoffs. Get rid of the net championship stuff. We don't need that anymore if you're only going 70-50-30. You can have the first tournament, 70 players. Everyone competes. And you start with your points, what you've accumulated from the year, and you get into a one-game situation. And whoever does what they do, if you win the event and you're way out, you know, and you're in the 60s, and you get 2,000 points, okay, then you move up a ton. It's a true playoff system. Same thing for the 50-person tournament. And you can do the same thing for the 30-person tournament, where you could set it up such that, yeah, basically if you win the tour championship, you're going to get the whole thing. And you don't have to have the net strokes thing, which seems to annoy a lot of people. Although I really don't mind it that much. I think it's not that hard to figure out. But I don't like the idea necessarily of having a 10-stroke difference between the start and the end of the field. But I don't necessarily mind the starting strokes idea. So there's a lot to figure out here, is what I'm trying to say. There's a lot to figure out that we don't know. And I don't think that the tour entirely knows. I don't think they've settled it all. But I do think that there is a good rational explanation for trying to have more no-cut events as part of the designated series. They don't all have to be. I don't think they all have to be. And I understand the value of having small field guaranteed money designated tournaments that almost in a way help the non-designated tournaments, because if they serve as a pathway into the designated series, into the FedEx Cup playoffs in a more substantial way, then you can go to those sponsors and say, yes, keep paying us to have a purse of $8.5, $9, $10 million a year. And it doesn't sound as crazy, because if maybe you're not playing well in the designated series for whatever reason, and you're worried about your spot in the top 50 in the FedEx Cup points, because if you don't get there, you're thrown out for the next year. You're totally dropped out. Well, all of a sudden, that makes those three tournaments between the designated tournaments interesting. That makes July very interesting, early August very interesting, because all of a sudden, I think Wyndham Championship gets a good feel, because who wants to get kicked out of the top 50? If you get kicked out of the top 50, then you don't get a free $1.2 million, basically. That's worth a lot of money. So I think that there is some value in having the limited field events and having the full field, full cut, regular PGA Tour events working in tandem together like that. Do I think 70 to 78 is the right number? No, I don't think so. I would like to see something like 90, 96, something like that as the number to get into a designated tournament. That way you could still have a small cut. Maybe you cut to the top 60 in ties, or top 55 in ties, something like that. Or you can do it still top 65 and you have 90 players. 90 works, because then you're cutting 25 guys. The odds of the best players being in the bottom 25 guys of a field, pretty low. So the odds are you're going to get most of the top players, and the couple that aren't playing good, they don't want to be there anyway. They're not playing well. They don't want any part of that. Let them go home. And they can still get guaranteed money. You could still say, hey, if you miss the cut in a designated tournament, we're going to give you $75,000, regardless of where you finished. If you didn't make the cut, here's your check. Get out of here. And that still works. And then you could say, okay, you've made a cut. Therefore, the FedEx Cup points apply to you because you made the cut, and that works out. And I still think you could do it very well from a presentation standpoint. You could still have, you could do threes off of 1 and 10 if you had to in reverse style, you know, V style order of send off. You can make it work. with 90 players. You make it work with 132, 144, and 156. Surely you can do it with 90 and have just the right number where there is some risk of not being able to shoot a final round 63 and move up the leaderboard a ton. But at the same time, basically ensure you're going to get money for showing up. And I don't think anyone would really bat an eye at that. And you go, okay, well, you know, close to 100. Because if the Masters comes along every year and we all go, well, does it feel close to 100 or is it closer to 90? But no one's like, oh man, we need 144 at Augusta. No, that's not the point. So if you, it feels like 90 is a good number for what amounts to an invitational series, an invitational tournament. And that's a series that everyone, most of the same people are going to participate in. I think you could draw a little bit more with that 90 number from hot guys currently. You could even draw a little bit from the Korn Ferry Tour guys. If maybe they're doing, I don't know, number one or number two in the Korn Ferry Tour list could come over and play a designated tournament. That'd be pretty cool. You come up with different ways to make this work and be a way of helping your product, because then you pay attention to the Korn Ferry Tour, you pay attention to PGA Tour's regular events, you pay attention to current form, who did what last season. Like, you got to keep a lot of things together. I think that's a good thing. I think that would be a good thing for consumers to take in and become more engaged with the product. So I guess that's where I leave on that. But there's still so much to understand, so much to figure out, and I don't think very much of it has been determined. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming weeks, months, as we figure out more of this. You'd figure they try to get a handle on this by May at the worst, because there's only a couple months left in the season at that point. And then they're going to need to make some decisions so that everybody who's involved knows exactly what they're playing for. And they have, let's say, 6 or 8 tournaments to figure it out. And they'll know what they're doing. Otherwise, I get the sense that there are going to be a lot of upset rank and file kind of players that aren't going to know what they need to do to keep their card for next year, other than vaguely get in the top 70 in FedEx Cup points. And then after that, shrug your shoulders. So they need to figure that out right away. All right, the second part of the show, or I guess third part of the show really, is something I wanted to get into about TV coverage. And it's really coming on the back of watching the Arnold Palmer Invitational while I was down in Orlando. And I didn't get to watch it every day, right? I mean, I watched some on my phone, watched some on the TV at our house, watched more on Sunday for sure when all of our golf was wrapped up for the week. And it just felt to me like the NBC telecast is an absolute mess right now. And it makes it even worse when you consider how far CBS has come out from, what was it, 2-3 years ago, where they were just the worst. I think it was Riviera in 2020. Maybe it was 2019. I don't remember what it was. But whatever it was, where they just showed, it felt like 6 golf shots in an hour and a ton of commercials and useless interviews with executives and sponsors, and everyone hated it. And from that moment on, CBS Sports committed to getting better. They brought in Seller Shy, who's been a fabulous executive producer, fabulous at the helm, and has done a great job. They've kind of modified the team that they have, but not that much. I mean, Colt Knost has been a great addition. Other than that, I mean, Amanda Renner has done a great job in evolving as an interviewer and evolving her role, which has been cool to see. Dottie Pepper has been great. Frank Nablo has always been wonderful. Trevor Immelman has been a nice surprise, I think, so far. I didn't really know what to expect from him, but the product continues to get better, too. Not only does the commentary team get better, but so, too, do the folks who are doing the back-end stuff, the technology stuff. I mean, the shot predictor thing, I'm not sold on that. I don't really like that, but I do love having yardage book stuff. They do drones really well. They give you better context of what's going on, and they seem to focus more on the golf than the golf-adjacent stuff. And it just makes for a better telecast. Meanwhile, you've got NBC ripping out all the carpet and trying to start over this year. You know, they got rid of Roger Maltby. They got rid of Gary Koch. Those guys were in those jobs for 30, 32 years each. And I understand that there needs to be turnover and you need new voices in golf. And that's totally fine. Do I like the way NBC did it? No, not really. I don't think that was right to do it the way they did it to Raj and Gary Koch. And to not even let them have a send-off PGA Tour event. They had a send-off Champions Tour event, technically, because of the PNC Championship. And I just don't, that didn't sit well with me. But then they go and bring in Smiley Kaufman, who was doing commentary anyway, and I think Smiley does a good job. John Wood's great. Really, really fantastic. And then you have Aaron Oberholzer come in, who's he does a good job. He's not, I feel like he just doesn't do enough, so maybe he'll build into this role a little bit, but never really did enough in this kind of job to warrant that kind of upgrade. Then you bring back Brad Faxon, where he was with Fox, did a little with NBC until he decided he wanted to be a teacher or a tour player again. And so he went back into that line of work. And you've got Paul Azinger and Dan Hicks in the 18th Tower. And I think my struggle is that technically NBC hasn't evolved. It's still the same stuff, still the same product that you see on Golf Channel week to week when they lead into CBS. I realize CBS produces that. It just looks and feels stagnant. And they just spend so much time not doing the golf. Like they haven't gotten the memo. They haven't understood what I guess CBS went through with public backlash to their really crappy coverage. And they're not changing. And I really struggle with that because I know NBC doesn't do the vast majority of PGA Tour events, but Golf Channel represents the vast majority of PGA Tour events because they do Thursday and Friday for all of them. So it is difficult for me to watch golf knowing that NBC has cut a lot of budget, not only for the PGA Tour, from the LPGA Tour, the Champions Tour. They've cut so much budget. They've cut so many people in front of the camera, behind the camera, with bylines, without bylines. They've done it in the name of saving money that they have overpaid to the PGA Tour for rights, that they have overpaid for cable rights, for network rights, and this stuff's locked up for a decade. That's why all these cuts happened so quickly when the contract got signed. Well, you got to save some money somewhere. So that means they don't have a weekly interviewer anymore. They have whoever's the Golf Central person on site. That's the interviewer. So that could be Todd Lewis, it could be Rex Hoggard, could be Damon Hack, could be Cara Banks, could be Steve Sands. I mean, it could be anybody, really. And they want to save on, I guess, having that one extra body there a week, which I guess in the grand scheme of things doesn't seem like that much money to me. I mean, you're going to pay them regardless. They're staff. So if you're paying them, what's the difference whether you fly them in or fly them out or not? I don't understand that. But I guess they're just trying to make it a little bit simpler from a standpoint of personnel who are at tournaments. Nevertheless, it doesn't feel like they've taken a step forward here. And I don't necessarily mean that about the individuals involved. I mean, to a degree, yes, because Azinger is just bad. I loved Paul Azinger when he was at ABC. He had a great foil in Faldo. They got along well. They complimented each other. They saw golf differently. And I thought that was really interesting in the booth. And by the way, Mike Tirico deserves a lot of credit because he let them play off of each other. Mike Tirico is so talented, really, really good at this job of being a play-by-play guy, a host. That's why NBC paid him so much money to take that role. That's why he does Sunday Night Football. He's really good at it. But in his role with Dan Hicks, Azinger just says stuff that's verifiably false with data. Like you can look up stats and go, that's not true. Supposedly he said something, I want to say at Honda, where he was talking about the leader of the tournament. He goes, yeah, he's leading the field in strokes gained this week. No crap, that's how it works. Like to say stuff so obvious and sometimes so wrong, it makes the golf fan who is somewhat educated about the sport just a turn off, and it's not helping the person who's a casual viewer because they don't know what the heck's going on. And if it's true or not. And I think that's a huge disservice to the sport. that's the reason why the UFC, for example, works so hard to control their product from end to end, how it's presented. And I watched my first UFC pay-per-view in probably 20 years this weekend. And the quality of the production work is fantastic. I mean, they have great prepackaged videos. They do good graphics. They use cameras very well. I mean, obviously, they're in a very small space. They analyze things well. They give you good data. All that stuff just happens very quickly, very seamlessly. Same thing happens with F1. F1 telecasts are tremendous. They get you exactly what you need, when you need it, and not much extra. NBC does not do that very well. They still are presenting tournaments the same way they did 20 years ago, when really all you just needed was Tiger Woods to be there, and everyone was glued. And I'm not saying that the best players now aren't draws, but it needs to be a total package. It needs to be, hey, these are great players playing golf. Here's some information that's really interesting about the course or strokes gained or the swing or this shot or none of that. It's just not there in this product right now. And you could do this different ways. You don't have to do it CBS's way. I think you could go in, lean in on data and technical stuff. CBS has started to do that a little bit more, which I like, but not crazy. You could really lean in on data. You could do live shot by shot of strokes gained. You could do a lot more technical analysis of how shots are pulled off and executed. You could do a whole lot more insight from the caddy perspective of John Wood or the player perspective of Smiley Kaufman. Don't have them talk about shots in the same way that you would have Coke and Maltby do it. Have them really rely on their expertise and do that. I mean, the amount of time that they talked about Tim Tucker, who is Kurt Kitayama's caddy, former caddy to Bryson DeChambeau, the amount of time they spent talking about it was like they got together in a meeting beforehand. It was like, look, if this Kitayama guy gets a chance, then we're going to talk about Tim Tucker nonstop. Like, nonstop. And yes, I'm sure Tim Tucker was quite important to Kurt Kitayama winning, but not that important. Not to the amount that they mentioned him. And I think that was a really, just a struggle. Just a real struggle. And I don't know. I really don't know. And so I guess at the end of the day, as a viewer, when you see coverage that doesn't seem to evolve against a product that is evolving, you get the sense that there's either defeatism, there's a budget issue, both, just complacency. I don't know. But something needs to happen at NBC. And I don't know exactly how that's going to work out. But it feels like there is a very stark contrast the other way now between CBS and NBC. Whereas 5 years ago, it was the opposite. I mean, they were just bringing in Azinger and I don't know. They had Bones and they had John Wood coming in. And it felt like that was an upgrade because Bones was great. John Wood's great. Become even better. It just felt like that was going in the right direction, but not now. Now you still got Tommy Roy at the helm, right? I mean, I don't know. I just don't like it. I don't really like watching the NBC events right now. And I hope that changes this week. The players is the perfect place to bring out some toys and upgrade some things and just put a better product out there. But last week would have been a great time too with a designated tournament. So I don't see what the change is going to be, but I know that a change has to come. It has to be better, has to evolve, or otherwise it just feels like 10 weeks of the year are going to open ourselves to players not getting highlighted as well and fans kind of tuning things out. And I didn't feel quite the same amount of buzz about the API final round compared to Genesis or Phoenix for that matter. And I don't know if that's a product of any level of influence of the TV network and the quality of coverage, but it felt to me like, hey, CBS is really putting a lot of effort into this. They're treating it like a big deal. And that has a way of kind of permeating. Whereas if you have Azinger come on and say some bogus garbage, you go, oh man, he doesn't even care. He's not even trying. And if you're not trying, it shows. And I think that discourages people from watching and taking an interest in the product. That's just my thought on it. I don't know if you agree. I would love to hear from you if you do or don't agree. You can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. I'm on Twitter, @RyanBallingy. Either way is really easy to get a hold of me. Happy to take your comments and questions. If you do listen to us via podcast service, please give us a 5-star review or leave a comment. Helps us reach more people. We're always trying to do that, even 20 years after doing this show, which I started in 2002. So this is year 21 for this show, even though we've taken a few years off here and there. We will talk about the players next week. We'll probably try to touch a little bit on DP World Tour stuff and anything else that comes up in the intervening time between the Gold Boy showing up on the 72nd hole with the trophy in hand for the winner of the Players' Championship this year and the first tee shot on Thursday morning. I'm Ryan Balaji. Thank you for listening to the show, for supporting Golf News Net. Thanks so much. We will talk to you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.